Ambition Podcast, where we bring out the best in life, community, and the workplace. I'm your host, Paul Collinton. Today's guest is Roger Goodman, one of the veterans of the infamous Stonewall Rebellion in New York City in 1969 that sparked the modern gay rights movement. Roger is a trailblazer, someone who made a decision to be his authentic self in 1965 at a time when all of the odds were against him. His story makes my own story and millions of other stories possible. He has such an important and historical perspective to share about our community, and it was an honor to interview him. Today, he'll share his thoughts on the current state of LGBT culture, what is queer versus gay, and why the LGBT community is a tribe. Roger, thank you so much for being here today.
So what do you want to talk about, sweetheart?
Everything. I guess we just don't have enough time. We don't have enough time to cover everything. I wanted to actually start with the inauguration. I think that this has such historic significance, of course, not only because the president mentions Stonewall specifically, but also because it's the first time a sitting president has ever acknowledged gay rights in an inaugural address. As a veteran of Stonewall, what is your take on the president's remarks?
Well, I think it's even more historic because he's black.
Yeah.
So he's the first black president who is also the first president to even mention gay rights. And he says that the journey isn't over until his gay brothers and sisters have equal rights in this country. And to mention Stonewall in the same breath with Selma is a really watershed moment. It's a really stunning historical moment. It sort of made me get teary-eyed because I felt like he was talking to me when he said Stonewall. Because I'm one of the few men left alive from Stonewall. Most of those men are dead. We lost an entire generation of gay men. And that's the generation that died, the Stonewall generation. That's my generation. And that's the generation that died off. So we're missing a whole bucket of wisdom that we're never going to get back. And I felt like he was talking to me specifically because I was there. And it really affected me emotionally. Because I never thought it would happen. When I was at Stonewall, I wasn't thinking about what was going to happen in 2013.
No, bet.
You know, what I was worried about was getting past the cops and not getting my head split open. And getting the cops out of there and not letting them take over the bar. That's what I was concerned about. I wasn't concerned about any more rights than that. I think when Stonewall happened, we were not really concerned about a national LGBT rights movement. We were concerned about police harassment and having to be forced to live with shame in a closet. That was the concern. And so when the cops came to bust the bar because the graft payoff had not been made to the police by the mafia, who owned the bar, the police came and raided it. They were not supposed to raid it, but they did raid it because they didn't get paid off not to. And so we stopped them. And because that was such an important moment in my life in terms of my queer identity and my spiritual identity and political identity, when Obama said what he said, I really felt like he was talking to me. And I thought, how many of my brothers are left alive? Not many. And I should not be alive.
Yeah, so, you have a very powerful story I heard about back in 1995 where you actually died during a coma.
Yeah, I was in a 10-day coma and I died. And they thought it was an irreversible coma, so they were going to extubate me. I was intubated and on a ventilator, on life support. And they thought it was an irreversible coma, and I was dying. And they were going to pull the life support. But just before they were going to turn it off, like split-second timing, Paul. I mean, they tried resuscitating me with paddles, with electrical paddles, and they didn't get a pulse. And just before they were going to turn off life support, I opened my eyes and pointed to the tube in my throat to have them take it out. And I came back to life. But that's because I had a lot of work to do. And I've been doing the work since then, since 1995. Actually, I fought for my life from 1995 to 2002. And for the last 10 years, I've really been doing the work that I was given to do by waking up.
How has your life changed since that experience? You've obviously done a ton of very important work, but what new perspective did that bring once you had that second chance?
It made me a far more compassionate human being. It made me able to listen to people more and hear where they're at, to empathize with them in ways I never was able to before. And one of the things that I do with my life is be a spiritual director, and it really helped me in my spiritual direction practice. Mm-hmm. Because I was able to listen to my clients more deeply, and I was able to listen more with my heart than my ears. Something changed in me, and I don't know that I can actually put my finger on it. All I know is that I became a bigger human being than I was before I died. I had a much more powerful connection to the world, to face my mortality, made me really aware of how I relate to people. It made my relationships be much more real, much more authentic. You know, after I came out of the coma, it took 2 years to really be able to function again because the neural pathways had been destroyed by the coma. A lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them. And I had to relearn how to walk, and I had to relearn how to eat. I had to relearn how to read music because I was a concert artist, and I had to relearn how to play the harpsichord. I had to relearn how to turn a corner. I had to relearn everything. And it took nearly 2 years to do that. So that was my work, was coming back to life, to as full a life as I could have. And after about 2 years, which would have made it 1997, I continued my chaplaincy work and my spiritual direction practice. And it wasn't just my death that changed me. It was the entire AIDS war that changed me, Paul. You know, that was a really terrible time. And the thing that intrigues me is that the thing that happened in the 1980s and 1990s, which was our Holocaust, it was a real Holocaust. I call it our genocide.
Wow.
I really see queer people as an ethnicity. We are a tribe, and we've been around since the beginning of time. We're probably the longest-lived tribe on Earth. But the work that I was given to do by having to wake up in 1995 was that I needed to create transformational change in people. And I did that by teaching for 35 years. I was on the faculty at DePaul University for 24 years. And taught there on the faculty, and I also taught privately. But then I concertized internationally, and I was making recordings. And what I did when I performed was create community. I actually changed the members of my audience to bigger people than they were when they walked in the concert hall. They walked in as complete strangers, and they walked out as neighbors. And members of a community of experience. That was part of my work. I also felt that I was called to be an Episcopal priest and decided that I needed to go to seminary in the middle of my concert career. So I went to seminary for 4 years, 3 years at one seminary and 1 year at another seminary, and I wanted to be ordained a priest in the Episcopal Church, and it took 7 years to go through the ordination process, and it turned out to be a really horrible, soul-shattering, rapidly homophobic experience for me.
Oh, wow.
That took me 3 years to get over. As soon as I was not ordained, they started ordaining openly gay and lesbian people, but they were not queer. They were just very discreet, very assimilated, non-frightening, non-threatening men and women who happen to have sex with the same gender.
Wow. You mentioned the word queer, and we had spoken about that over our emails as well. And
yeah.
I'm wondering how you realized that you were queer, and how did the culture of that time, backing up to when you came out and were coming to terms with it, how did that affect your coming out process?
I came out in 1965, when very few people in this country were out. There were people out, but it was relatively few. Almost every LGBT person was closeted because it was illegal to be queer. It was legal to be gay. It wasn't that you couldn't just engage in gay sex. That was illegal. But to be gay was illegal. You could be arrested for it and thrown in jail. So I came out in 65 because I had to. I had no choice. If I did not come out, I probably would have committed suicide. So I came out like, I tell people I came out like Quaker puffed wheat shot from cannons. There used to be a commercial for Quaker puffed wheat, the cereal, the morning cereal, where they shot the wheat out of a cannon. And that's how I felt when I came out of the closet. And I forced the people at my college to deal with me as a gay man, as an openly gay man, and I did it in the classroom as well. And I was alone as a gay man. I knew all the other gay men on campus because we all knew each other, but I was the only person out to the whole college and conservatory community. All the other gay men were just out to themselves. Mm-hmm. It was a very closed circuit. And I opened it up, but I still felt very alone. And I considered myself gay. I identified as gay because I've been gay my entire life. You know, I knew I was gay when I was 5, maybe even earlier. So when I came out, I was claiming that identity. But over the course of time, particularly in 1969 when I was at Stonewall, I felt for the first time a feeling of community and solidarity, a feeling of brotherhood and sisterhood with my gay and lesbian brothers and sisters. And I felt like I was a member of a community. I was not alone anymore. That started me doing a tremendous amount of work spiritually and politically to find out who gay and lesbian people were spiritually and politically. And over the course of time, discovering our mythology and our arts and our history and our politics and our spirituality and our mysticism and our rituals and our rites of initiation and our poetry and our literature, I realized that we're a tribe. And the more I understood the tribal aspect of LGBT people, the more I understood the difference between being gay and being queer. For me, being gay is a gestalt. Being queer is a gestalt. Being gay is who I have sex with. Being queer is every single moment of my day and night. It is everything I do. It is every ounce of my identity. Everything I do comes from my queerness. My politics come from my queerness. My spirituality comes from my queerness. My aesthetic comes from my queerness. I was playing harpsichord concerts in full leather. I was so unabashedly queer when I was playing and so unashamedly honest in who I was that people had to change. It gave my audiences permission to see themselves more deeply. If I could be up there exposing my heart and my soul the way I did without any shame or any guilt or any kind of asking for forgiveness for who I was, that gave my audiences permission to find those places inside themselves that were difficult for them.
Absolutely.
And to live with those things and to take them on and own them.
I think people should always be who they are. Let me ask you this. Do you see a future in the coming decades where being queer is not a tribe, it's the norm, and not ostracized or something that is makes people feel shameful? Do you see do you see that future ahead?
Yes, I do. And it's a very tricky future, Paul. Because to my mind, we will never, if we're smart, if we know what we're doing, and right now we don't know what we're doing, but if we knew what we were doing, we would never lose our tribal identity. We would just become a larger and larger and larger tribe, but still remain tribal and not be in any way demonized or demeaned or face any kind of bigotry or oppression, because we would be not only just accepted but celebrated for who we are. And I want to be celebrated for being queer. I don't want to be celebrated for being a gay man who blends into straight society. I want to be a queer man in my identity as a queer man and never ever lose that. Not ever. And I'm really worried that the thing that LGBT people want right now more than anything else is to become like the larger majority of the world, to blend in, to say to the larger majority of the world, don't be afraid of us, you shouldn't be frightened of us, we're just like you, we're all human beings in the world together, and there's no difference between us. And my spirituality and politics say there is a tremendous difference between us. I am not straight. I will never be straight. I don't want to be straight. But I want to be celebrated by straight people as a queer man,
yes,
not as someone like them.
Don't you think, though, Roger, that we do all have some similar ambitions in the sense
of course
that we want to be loved, we want to feel secure, we want to have our needs taken care of, and we want to be able to raise a family and have all the same rights as everyone else if we choose to go that path?
Yes, I think that has to happen. And the last thing you said is really vital. If we choose to go that path. I don't choose to go that path. I live with my beloved Jerry, but I don't know that we're going to ever get married. And we're certainly not going to have a six-figure income and two golden retrievers and a white picket fence with a mowed lawn and 2.5 kids to raise from China. We're not going to do that because it's not who we are. But if I have brothers and sisters who want to do that, they should have every opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
We have a spirituality that is unlike the spirituality of straight men. And I think that we have a specific collective unconscious that happens with an ethnicity. Jews have a collective unconscious because of all the pain they have suffered during the eons of time that Jews have been around and oppressed. Native Americans have a collective unconscious because of how they've been oppressed and wiped out. Peoples who have lived lives of oppression and pain develop this thing called the collective unconscious, and we have that because we've always been oppressed.
Roger, you talked a little bit about oppression.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, since the LGBT community has been oppressed for so long, if that went away, how do you think that individuals would be better able to live up to their full potential?
I think we would be magnificent people. We already are pretty magnificent people, just in who we are. I mean, we give color to the world. The world's a pretty great place, but queer people give the world its color and its beauty and its joy and it's laughter and it's humor and it's drama and it's arts and it's poetry. And I think that if we were not oppressed, we could be the compassionate, altruistic, volunteering, impassioned people that we can be. If we're oppressed, it's very hard for that to happen. You know, one of the things I talk about in my book, Thoughts of a Tribal Elder, One Queer Man's Journey from the Ashes Risen, is that during the years of the plague in the 1980s and 90s, we reached our potential. Because in the midst of all that death, an extraordinary community of life rose up. In all that darkness, we brought light. In all that suffering, we brought life in the midst of death. We took care of ourselves. We took care of our sick because no one else would. We weren't allowed into emergency rooms, Paul. We went to hospitals and were turned away.
That's outrageous.
We weren't allowed in restaurants. We weren't allowed in our apartments. Landlords evicted us. We were dying on park benches in the streets. We weren't allowed in schools. We weren't allowed to teach. We weren't allowed. We were like the lepers. We were contemporary lepers. And so we had to form our own social service agencies. We had to phone our own psychotherapy practices. We had to phone our own medical practices. We had to form our own buddy systems. We had to form our own spiritual places of nurturance and centering. And we did that. We had to learn how to volunteer with expecting no gift in return, nothing in return. We didn't do it for any kind of gain. We did it because we were filled with compassion and filled with love. And I talk about that so much in my book.
I'm glad you brought up your book, Roger, because I actually wanted to ask you a little bit more about it. And I wanted to know what is the most important message that you would like people to take away after reading your book.
The most important message is that transformation is possible, that internal transformation can happen even in the midst of oppression. It can happen, and that community can be formed even in the midst of antagonism. I want people to take that away from the book, that we are a people of endless possibility. And that possibility is within our grasp, but we have to see it and recognize it and own it and allow ourselves to be transformed into that possibility. And that's what I want people to take away from my book, that we don't have to be, woe is me, I'm gay and I don't know what to do. And, you know, I'm really sorry I'm gay. But I am, that's how I was born, so, you know, that's how I have to live, and that's okay, it's okay that I'm gay, but, you know, I'm sorry I'm in your way. That's not any way to live. I want to live in a community of people who say, I'm beautiful, I am magnificent, I'm an artist, I'm a creator, I'm a co-creator with the deity, I help create this world. I create creation. I think that's what my book is saying. And my film, From the Ashes Risen, is going to say the same thing. It's going to be about the community that formed in the 1980s and 90s. It's not going to focus so much on the death that happened, but on the life that happened during that time. In Chicago specifically, because nothing has ever been done about it, about what happened in the Chicago area during the AIDS epidemic. All the documentaries have been out of San Francisco and New York. The latest one that's entitled How to Survive a Plague is all about ACT UP in New York. and how it was formed, and the politicization of people with AIDS, and how we forced the FDA to put on a fast track approval of drugs, which could have taken 10 years and they were approved in a year. We did something back then, and that community can happen again. And the message I want to people to take away from my book is that that community can happen. We can be an extraordinary people. And one of the things that does that for gay men particularly, and I, because I don't know about lesbians, Paul, I'm not a woman.
Fair enough.
I can't speak for lesbians.
Yeah.
And I can't really even speak for gay men generally, because I'm me. I have to speak for me.
Yep.
All I can do is offer my story and say, this is what I've learned through the course of my life as a queer man. And this is what I have to offer you. You can take what you like and leave the rest. And it's okay. You can leave behind whatever you want to leave behind. I'm just here to offer you the gift. How you receive the gift, what you do with it, is up to you. I have nothing to do with that. I have no responsibility in that. My responsibility is to give you what I know, to give you what I've learned. And that's what my book does.
It sounds like you have a lot of great advice, especially for people who are already, who have already come to terms with their sexuality. I'm wondering what you might say to someone who is just discovering their sexuality or their gender identity and going through the coming out process.
I know exactly what I would say to them, Paul. I would say, talk to your tribal elders. Talk to those who have come before. Listen to the stories of those who have come before you. Listen to the stories of the people who love themselves, of the queer people who are absolutely in love with who they are as queer people. And that will help you find your identity, to love yourself as a queer person. If you try to do that in the midst of people wagging their fingers at you, saying you're an abomination and you deserve to be stoned to death, you're never going to love yourself. And if you only hang out with your peers, you're never going to gain the wisdom of self-love by listening to the stories of those who have come before. I think dialogue between the generations is vital for young people who are coming to know themselves as sexual beings and as gender entities. You know, I think there is so much transgenderism in queer youth now. It's really wonderful. I run into to queer youth who are so gender fluid, and they're learning from their elders that it's okay, that it's a good thing. But they're learning from their elders who are equally gender fluid. And if I, you know, when I come in contact with young people, they say to me, wow, I really want that. And I think you can have it.
Absolutely.
Just listen to my story and you can have it.
What do you think is the biggest culture change towards the LGBT community since you went through that process of coming out?
I think that's really complicated. I think we've become much more social and interactive. When I came out, we were not interacting with each other except in small, dark, dank bars where you couldn't touch each other, you couldn't dance, you couldn't eat. You just went in order to pick someone up for the night or for an hour or two. And that's how you met people. The bars were places to pick up people for sex, and that's the only thing they functioned for. They were owned by the mafia. Gay people and lesbian people never owned our own bars or restaurants until 1970, after Stonewall. Then we started throwing the mafia out of ownership of the bars and took the bars back and started to turn our community into one of social interaction. That's a major cultural change than what I had when I came out, because there was no social interaction, which is why Stonewall was such a watershed for me. It was a real flashpoint for me, because here were all these gay men and lesbians, hundreds, interacting with one cause, fighting one enemy, from all walks of life, saying we're a community. We are people who can interact with each other and who can fight for our freedom and our liberation.
One of the things that you talked about that I think is so important is community. How has our community changed, and where does it need to go?
There's very little caring in the gay community now. There's very little connection in the gay community right now. You know, I spoke to a bartender, not a bartender, a bar owner, I'm sorry. I spoke to a bar owner about the possibility of him helping to fund the film. And he said, well, what's your film about? And I said, it's really about the formation of community, because, you know, there's really no community now. And he became irate. He started screaming at me, saying, of course we have community. Look at my bar. There's community in there every night. And I said to him, sure, that's a community of white, high education degree men, white collar jobs with six-figure incomes, who have PhDs and master's degrees, and there is not a black person in your bar, there is not a Native American person in your bar, there is not a Hispanic person in your bar, there is not a woman in your bar, neither straight nor lesbian. What the fuck kind of community is that? And everyone in the bar is on Grindr, looking to see who they can pick up for the night. That's not community. So the community that we had at Stonewall became the community of licentious sex, which became the community of AIDS, which became the community of life and love and light. And then when AIDS disappeared, that community of life and love and light disappeared because there was no need for it anymore. And we became a community of individuals who are out to make everything for ourselves. Me first, you second. And my feeling is it needs to be you first. I need to love myself first. Then I can love you. But I am not the central person. You know, Jesus, you should forgive the name. You should forgive the word. But Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself. That he wasn't saying, he said, love God, love your neighbor as yourself. He wasn't saying love God, then love yourself, and then love your neighbor. I mean, love your neighbor and then love yourself. He was saying love God, love yourself, and then love your neighbor. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. So we do come first. We have to learn to love ourselves. But once we reach that point, we give it away. We have to give it away, and I talk about that in Thoughts of a Tribal Elder so much, about giving away our self-love, giving away our wisdom, our self-knowledge, giving away who we are so that we can have more of it. We can't keep it unless we give it away.
I think it's so wise. You have to love yourself and put yourself first before you can pass on that love to others and contribute to your community at your full capacity. I can also totally relate to what you said earlier about everyone standing around in a bar on Grindr. I get what you're saying there. And I do think that the gay community needs a place to have a community, like you said. And one thing that I feel that this blog is trying to accomplish is to learn from elders and to learn from different experiences and to take the best experiences and the best knowledge and have a place where people can learn and grow and develop. And so that's what I'm really trying to do here. And I really appreciate your perspective so much.
What you're doing is a wonderful thing. It's courageous. It's visionary. It's revelatory, it's revolutionary, it's utterly queer. And I hope I hope someday I get to meet you.
I would love that.
So would I.
Are you, you're located in Chicago, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I've been there once. I was there in 2011. Yeah, 2011. And I actually have family out there. So I'll let you know if I ever make it out there. I'm currently living in Denver right now.
Really?
Yeah.
Why does it say on my cell phone when you called that it was from California?
Because I was born and raised in California, but I moved...
Oh, that's the area code.
Yeah, I moved to Denver about a year ago.
Okay.
So I would love to meet you someday, and thank you for the kind comments about the blog. I'm really just... What I'm really doing with this is listening to my heart and going off of that. And so that's what we're trying to do.
That's all you can do, Paul. All you can do is listen to your heart. That's where everything is. I have a very powerful belief in the divine. It's the center of my life. And I believe that the divine lives in our hearts. That's where divinity, that's where the deity dwells. That's where love dwells. That's where connection dwells. That's where compassion dwells. That's where caregiving and caretaking dwells. That's where altruism and generosity dwells. Everything that is good dwells in the heart. And for you to follow your heart is a most extraordinary and wonderful thing. And I love you for that. Don't ever stop.
I won't.
Good. You've got my heart.
Powerful. I think that the generation that is coming out and the generation that is currently developing who they are, I think they have so much to learn from someone like you. And I just thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
Paul, I really appreciate that. I think that young people do have a tremendous amount to learn from me and my peers, who also have stories to tell. I'm not the only elder who has a story to tell. I have my story to tell. But there are other elders of the tribe who have stories to tell, because that's our role.
Yeah.
Tribal elders have always been the carriers of the oral history, have always been the carriers of the spirituality and the connectivity. They've always been looked to for the wisdom. But I know in my heart that the future of the world lies in queer youth.
Yep.
You are going to be the saviors of this world. And the only way you're going to do that is if there's a dialogue that goes on between you and your elders so that you can find your own identities and live those identities with great integrity and great self-love so that you can love your community of brothers and sisters and then in turn turn to the rest of the world and say, look what we've done.
Yeah.
You can do it too.
What, and this is my last formal question, but I'm wondering what challenges do you think we're going to experience? Because I think we are on the verge of a breaking point. I think that everything that's happening in our world right now, from technology to culture to ideas, I feel like it's on the cusp of major changes. And I'm wondering, what do you think is the biggest challenge that the queer community is going to face in the coming decade?
Spirit. Spirit. I think... we have to find our spiritual sides. We absolutely have got to find our spiritual sides. So long as we're stuck in materialism rather than spirituality, consumerism rather than spirituality, individualism rather than spirituality, we're not going to do anything to change the world. I really do think you're right. We're on the verge of something enormous. And you know, the Mayan calendar said that this is the end of the world.
Yeah.
Well, it is the end of the world. It's the end of the world as we know it, culturally and spiritually. And I think we're in for a major spiritual shift in the world and a major shift in community in the world. And I have a hunch, and it's my dream. It is my dream. I have a hunch that Hillary Clinton is going to be our president in 2016.
I hope so.
Yeah, really. I can't imagine to have a woman at the head of government of one of the most powerful countries in the world, if not the most powerful country in the world, to have a woman head up that country will change the world.
I think so. And I think she's the one to do it.
She is. She's really powerful. She's a strong woman. I love her a lot.
I guess we will find out in the next few years whether that comes true. Roger, thank you so much for being with us. To connect with Roger and learn more about his book and current projects, please visit his website at www.queerwitness.com.